My prime activity as a musician is as a composer, but my whole musical world centers around instruments. For me, composition is a process which takes place with the instrument in your hand, and specifically a string instrument. I'm very much, my musical world is very much made up of pulling strings and hitting them and pressing them and doing that sort of stuff. I am rather glad that I do see in recent decades that there is a return to tonality, a return to the concept that a melody is something magical. You cannot intellectualize a melody, you cannot explain a melody, you can experience it. This, for me, is very, very important. And this, of course, is the essence of modal music.
Russ Daly is a remarkable, unique musician and composer. His work is rooted in the ancient traditions of modal music, and yet it's innovative and contemporary. His primary instrument, of which he's an acknowledged master, is the Cretan lyra, the lyre, the instrument from whose name we derive the word lyric.
My first conscious memory is actually on my second birthday, because we boarded a ship from Southampton to go to Canada. It was a pretty sort of striking experience getting on this huge boat. And so I do actually remember the boat trip over, and that's when my memories actually start.
It's fitting that Russ Daly's earliest memories involve travel, because travel is one of the defining features of his life. He was born in 1952 in Norfolk in England. His father, who'd emigrated from Ireland, was an engineer whose work involved regular sojourns in other countries, and by his early teens, Ross had already spent time in Canada, England, Japan and America. And travel became a feature of his musical life too. In fact, he'd shown a natural ability for music early on, first taking a real interest in the classical guitar when he was 11.
Which was in many ways a somewhat unfortunate choice for somebody interested in classical music, because it was at that time, and to a large degree still is today, a classical instrument without a classical repertoire. There was no Mozart, no Beethoven, no Haydn. All we had really was transcriptions of works of Baroque composers such as Bach, for example, from other instruments, as a rule, usually from cello or from lute or violin. And then we had 20th century repertoire, which never did really appeal to me that much.
Still in his teens, in the mid-1960s, he was based in San Francisco. It was a time when that city was at the very center of the social and cultural upheaval that has since defined the decade. And the artistic revolution, heralded by the beat poets a decade before, was growing into a reality as artists and performers were drawn to this most open of American cities. It was here, in music venues like the fabled Fillmore, that Russ Daly heard a different kind of guitar playing. Young rock guitarists like Mike Bloomfield and Jerry Garcia were exploring new possibilities, mixing up genres, improvising, experimenting.
The groups coming out of San Francisco were particularly innovative and particularly interesting, even though many of them did actually subsequently get rather seriously bogged down by drugs in excess and things like that. But they were doing some interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm. Something else was happening in San Francisco that would have still been rare in other cities at this time. Stanford University was running a series of classical Indian and Iranian music concerts, and it was at one of these that Ross Daly first encountered Indian music. In the person of master sarod player Ali Akbar Khan. And he made a vital discovery, one that was to prove crucial.
I was enormously impressed with it because up until that time, in my studies of classical music, I'd always been very interested in the very complex and developed structures which are used in classical music, the forms. And also in the contemporary music, I was very impressed and very much interested and drawn to the whole sort of the freedom of it, the improvisation, all that sort of stuff, which was missing in the classical. But they didn't actually meet up. And the first thing which I think I connected to on an instinctive level, not so much out of knowledge, but on a more sort of an instinctive level, intuitive level, was that in this Indian music, I was seeing a meeting and combination and collaboration of all this elaborate structure and form together with the improvisational element. And that was the first thing which I think which drew me to it.
So here was a combination of the two elements that most appealed to him. The ornate structure of the classical coupled with the freedom and improvisation that he'd heard in the rock bands. But how could he marry these elements in his own playing?
The first thing I attempted to do was to try and play some of what I'd heard, imitate some of the sounds which I'd heard in this concert on my guitar at home. But I very quickly realized that, no, this music, to play it, you need an instrument specially made for it. So that's when I started to think about maybe I'd better start looking in other directions.
This new direction began with the study of the Indian sitar, a period that lasted for 4 years. He even studied under a master in India, but he reached an impasse.
I realized that, okay, North Indian classical music is a particularly demanding subject, the sitar which I was studying. You can dedicate your entire life 10 hours a day, and what you will become is an exponent of North Indian classical music, and that's it. And so I started to think, well, is that what I really want for myself? Is that my goal in life? It doesn't make sense for me to just become an exponent of some tradition into which I'm not born in the first place. And what I was actually doing, because I was always interested from a very early age in composition, was that all of this stuff which I was studying was eventually to become what you might call my source material for composition. So it didn't make sense to confine myself to this one tradition and spend my whole life playing this one instrument, this one specific tradition.
It was at this point that Ross Daly made what's arguably the single most significant decision of his musical life.
I sort of thought that, okay, I'll spend a few months on the island of Crete, which I'd visited previously with a friend, which I'd liked very much as a place, and I'd also heard the local tradition of lira playing, which had also made a very big impression on me. I was very impressed by that. And I thought, well, I'll spend some time on Crete and do some work on that lira, which I'd liked very much, and eventually sort of work my way back to India or something like that. But as it happened, I came to Crete in 1975, and on the second day of being here, I purchased a lira, and I did something rather strange. I also purchased a donkey. So I then traveled for 6 months all over Crete with all of my stuff loaded on a donkey, and I walked the entire island for 6 months. And every night I would stop in a village somewhere, and I'd meet people who some played well, some played just a little bit, and whoever played even just a little bit, I'd ask them to show me something, and that's how I started learning Cretan music.
Και ταιριάζε τα λόγια σου μαζί με τα δικά μου.
Όπα κοντά σου νιώθω τη χαρά κι αλλάγω σου τον τόνο. Όπα κι αλλάγω σου τον πόνο.
It dawned on me gradually that no, going back to India was not the thing for me. So I stayed on Crete. And I became the student of a very great lira player whose name was Kostas Mundakis. And he became my teacher and friend and colleague for the next 16 years up until the time of his death. And it was during that time that I also started going back and forth to Turkey quite a lot also and studying Ottoman classical music and also Turkish folk music and various other subjects as well that I started to sort of broaden out into what I came to realize was the broader world of what you might call modal music.
Modal music is based on modal scales rather than keys. It's an ancient form of music, more commonly associated with the East these days, but early European church music, such as Gregorian chant, was entirely modal, as was European classical music up until about 1550, when the major and minor key system began to evolve in response to the development of harmony.
And this whole world of modal music, if you look at it carefully, you'll see that it's a vast geographical area stretching roughly from northwest Africa to western China and encompassing nearly everything in between, in which there are traditions which are interrelated and interconnected on a historical level, not just, you know, sort of geographical, but there's a lot of, you know, historical connections between all of these traditions. So that within this vast geographical area, you have almost in each and every village something which is very special of their own, but you can see that it's all connected. And this was of particular interest to me, and I felt myself to have a rather special affinity for this whole sort of category of modal music. So basically what I considered myself to be from then on was a student of this particular type of music.
But what are the essential differences between modal music and the later Western system?
Modal music is what we call a monophonic type of music. It consists of a melodic line and rhythm, but it does not make use of harmony. Harmony, of course, being the coincidence of two or three notes at in the same moment in a special sort of arrangement. Western music, polyphonic music, makes use of harmony. What happens is, you could say that, okay, Western music has melody, harmony, and rhythm, whereas modal music has melody and rhythm, but does not have harmony. So somebody might say to you, okay, well, the one music has three elements, the other has two, therefore the one is richer. That is not actually true, though. Because the use of harmony imposes a certain limit on certain aspects of melody. For example, the use of what we call the tempered scale, which is in Western music, where we have an octave of 12 semitones. In Turkish classical music, for example, we have an octave of 53 equal intervals called koma, which is based on the old Pythagorean scale. So, even though we do not use harmony in modal music, it has enormous possibilities melodically, which you could not find in the tempered scale. there are certain elements of Irish music which are quite decidedly modal. Some of the older, the unaccompanied airs and things like that. Other aspects of Irish music are a sort of a they're sort of in between modality and the tonal system. There's plenty of modality also to be found in Breton music in the northwest of France. Certain Scandinavian idioms are also quite modal in nature. And then, of course, Europe in the broader sense, well, countries like Greece and Bulgaria and the like, there's plenty of modal traditions to be found there. And, you know, from the Middle Ages up until through the Renaissance, we see the gradual development of harmony, which brings about the necessity of the temperate scale, which appears later. And from that point on, that tradition starts to diverge quite seriously from the modal tradition, which moved in a different direction. The aspect of what I hear in this music is not the aspect of the traditional is not necessarily what I'm actually looking for, and not necessarily that which interests me. What I did encounter was that I would encounter certain pieces of music or certain things in different traditions which had a certain timelessness about them, that were things that their relevance didn't seem to be confined to one particular moment or period in time. They seem to stretch over vast stretches of time, their relevance, and it was something which meant something to people maybe 500 years ago, means something to people today, and it will mean something to people in maybe 500 years from now. There are other things in tradition, in any given tradition, which seem to me to be habit which is repeated and little more. So the aspect of the traditional per se was not that which interested me. That which interested me was the certain timelessness of certain things that you would find in traditions, which makes sense because if you're going to look for things which are of a timeless nature, a good place to start your search is within the context of something which has been around for a long time anyway. And so that's why tradition, or traditions, so to speak, are a good starting point for your search for the timeless. So that's what my search was all about, really, stretching over a rather large geographical area, of course. And eventually, all of these rather special things which I felt that I encountered during all of those years were to indeed become what you might call the source material for my own compositional work, and that's very much how I work today.
He was fortunate that his teacher, Kostas Mundakas, who was himself quite a conservative man, encouraged him to find his own voice.
In my early years of training, he obliged me to copy exactly everything he played in the minutest detail, exactly as he did it. And of course, I did that to the best of my abilities. When I got to the level where I was doing a reasonably good job of it, he then said to me, "Okay, now stop doing that. It's time to look for your own sound." And so I took his advice because that made sense to me. And so the context of looking for my own sound meant that included in my own sound would be the entirety of my musical experience, which would include Bach, it would include Jimi Hendrix, it would include Vilayat Khan, it would include all sorts of strange things which may seem to be on the surface very contradictory, the one to the other. But I myself, because it's all part of my life, perceive a thread running through. There's a certain sort of underlying common element there, which means that the one, for me, is quite a natural continuation of the other.
A recurring theme in Ross Daly's musical journey has been his collaborations with other musicians.
I I worked for 7 years with a very great Greek gypsy clarinet player called Vasilis Soukas, who unfortunately died in 1993. And, you know, I know the Greek gypsy clarinet tradition, which is wonderful, it's great. I'd never had much to do with it, you know, to actually working with it and things like that. I'd listened to it and I'd enjoy it very much. And we happened to play one piece together just at an impromptu session. And we both enjoyed it really enormously and wanted to continue that. So we continued playing together and we worked together, and it led to a collaboration of 7 years. Quite regularly collaborate with musicians from, as it turns out, quite a wide variety of different backgrounds. This was not something I set out to do. It never made sense to me to just to try and, as some producers would say, to marry this one tradition with the other and things like that. I'd never, or fusion or confusion. I never really went in for that sort of stuff. Because it never made sense to me. I was always concerned with the very personal aspect of it. I would happen to meet, during the course of my life, certain musicians who there was something about that person that really interested me and drew me to them. And where they were from was quite incidental. You know, one very good example is the Malian kora player Balaké Sissoko, who, through a series of rather interesting coincidences, I happened to meet. And I was very, very impressed with the way he played and the way he approached music. He sits there with his instrument, with his eyes closed and a huge smile on his face, and singing along with what he plays. And his obvious enjoyment of what he does is very, very inspiring. It certainly was to me. Of course, to be able to understand what he was doing, I did study to a certain degree the music of Mali. I did my best to understand it. Balaké is a more intuitive individual than I am, and so he didn't do that. He just sat down and played with me. It was very simple for him. I'm not quite able to do that, unfortunately. I always have to sort of study things a little bit, but that's just my way of approaching things. And so we felt an immediate connection, and we enjoyed very much playing together, and we were very pleased with the result that came out of it.
also collaborated with the group Hunhurtu from the Republic of Tuva, that remote, mountainous region nestled in between Mongolia and Siberia. This came about during his tenure as the artistic director of the cultural program of the Olympic Games in Crete in 2004.
This is something which came to me by chance, or what appears to be chance anyway. And from the time that I actually encountered these people until the time that we actually started a collaboration, there was a 2-year gap during which I spent 2 years studying quite intensively the music of Tuva and getting to understand it. Because the music of Tuva is very strange. I mean, for a start, you have people doing overtone singing, which means that a single person is singing simultaneously more than one note, two or even three in some cases at the same time. And for anybody from the Western world, this is a novelty, to say the least. But what is important is to get over this novelty and just start to see it as that's the way that these people make music. They don't see it as anything extraordinary or strange. This is just the way people sing there. And it's important to come to see it in the same light. Otherwise, it becomes a bit gimmicky. Our approach to it becomes gimmicky, not theirs. So it was very important for me to come to understand this music and to cease to see it as a novelty or as something which is a bit strange, but to see it as something which is quite natural and normal, which, you know, during the course of my 2-year study, I came to see it in very much that way, and to come into some sort of alignment with its actual aesthetic. The recording we made is actually a live recording from the concert itself, in which we had musicians. It was a total of 18 musicians involved in that project. So it was. It included the Shemirani family as well, as well as a clarinet player from Epiros, Alexandros Arkadopoulos, and two singers, one from Crete and one from Thrace in the north of Greece. So it was quite a complex and quite a large project in many ways.
The village of Houdetsi, up in the hills above Heraklion, is the site of a large house and gardens that Ross has called Labyrinth. The building houses a museum exhibiting a wide variety of stringed instruments that Ross has collected from around the world. And it also provides the site for the Labyrinth teaching seminars. These workshops are yet another aspect of Ross Daly's musical life. Masters of music in a variety of disciplines are invited to give seminars at Labyrinth, and Ross himself gives workshops teaching the principles of modal composition. Michiel van der Merle is a Dutch musician who's attended several of these workshops.
Well, these seminars work so well because they are very immersive. You stay in this tiny village of Hudetsi. You live close to the institute, and you basically spend all your time on music and perhaps on eating and drinking, but then again together with all the other musicians. So you spend a week being fully immersed in music only. I like Ross very much as a teacher, and I think he's very good at it for a number of reasons. One of them being that he will take his time to explain things very thoroughly until you understand it. And also he seems to hear when you're playing or trying to compose, when you're stuck, and he will come up with a suggestion at just the right moment.
That I'm a bit
yeah.
I think what you need there. You need a Hijaz conclusion there.
Yeah,
going up again to a village is a bit much after that Ushak movement there. So. At the very highest, go up to me, and start bringing it into a conclusion, a final conclusion there, Sounding good.
Acclaimed composer, musician and instrument maker, Stelios Petrakis was another of Ross's students.
Ross' story is really unique. Like an Irish man who came to Crete, and he's one of the best musicians I ever played with and I ever listened to, as a player and as a composer as well. His approach to music is, I would say, classical. So he has a vision. He's a composer, and he has a vision, and as an artist and as a artistical value, he's of a very, very high level I ever met and I ever listened to. And I'm so glad that I became one of his students.
And yet another student, Kelly Tomar, not only became a master of the lira, composing and collaborating with others, she also became Ross's wife and a member of the Ross Daily Quartet. Over feta and olives, she told me how she was inspired the very first time she saw him play.
I saw him playing the lira and I was enchanted by the picture. That was very strange because he looked so beautiful playing the lira. I loved all the other instruments he played in this concert, but it was the lira that I was enchanted with. Not just the sound, just the music, but the atmosphere that it created around him and around the whole theater. It was actually that night that I decided to play this instrument. I felt an emotion like jealousy. I wanted to do it too, in a way, you know? I felt this man looks so happy playing this instrument. Not happy because he was smiling, because he wasn't, but he looked so full, so complete. So I really wanted to do that too. It was like a kid's jealousy, not a jealousy in a bad way.
Is it true that as a student of the master musician Ross Daly, that you decided in the long run it would be just cheaper to marry the guy?
cheaper, okay. So I need to say in this point that Ross never took one drachma from me to teach me the lira. This I really have to say. I don't say it often because it's not a secret, but I think it's not that he offered me free lessons. He offered me a new life. And this is not counted in drachmas or euros, you know? So It's not cheaper or more expensive. It is just wonderful. It's wonderful to live next to your teacher and next to somebody that inspires you so much. And it's actually, he is actually my other half. Not just musically, but emotionally and everything, in everything, in every aspect of life.
There is a philosophy underpinning Ross's approach to music, or perhaps a view of life is a better way of putting it.
There's been a lot of dialogue over the last decades in the scientific community regarding whether people's tendencies are acquired or whether they're inherited or whether they come from, you know, they come with the package when you're born. I wouldn't pretend to know the answer to that question, but it's certainly true that people from a very, very early age do display very specific tendencies and certain things seem to be in their nature. I would suggest, you know, in my own case, that I've known since a fairly early age that, you know, music is the thing for me. And fortunately for me, I was reasonably good at it. And I know other people who from a very early age have displayed considerable interest in and even skills in things like mathematics or sports or whatever else. That meant that music for me was my sort of means of approaching and understanding many things. It was the prism through which I would see life. And I came to regard it as the language of my dialogue with what I consider to be sacred. I'm not implying any given religious tradition of any sort, no. I don't happen to belong to any. But what I mean is that for each person, there's something which gives a deeper meaning to being, and which is that which seems to give rise to being. So this is my way of approaching that deeper side of meaning through the medium of music, quite definitely. Other people would do that through the medium of mathematics, other would do it through the medium of gardening, other would do it through the medium of looking after animals, others would do it for, you know, the many, many different ways, just as there are an infinite number of different human natures. So each one would do it through his own nature. The important thing is for each person to find his own nature and live according to it.
Ross Daly's also designed a new version of the lira.
I designed this new type of lira, which incorporated elements from the Cretan and the Turkish lira. It incorporated sympathetic strings and the use of what we call javari bridges, which are used on Indian instruments. And so this new instrument came out of that, and I actually used the body designs of older liras from the 19th century, which I found to be more suitable. So it's a strange instrument which moves in two directions in time. It goes to the past for its shape and basic design to the old Cretan liras, and it goes forward in time in that it incorporates new elements like javari bridges and things like that. So the end result is an instrument which I play today, which has three playing strings and 22 sympathetic strings, the technique of which is just about the same as that of the Cretan lira, but with which also allows you to use many elements of the technique of the Turkish kemençe as well. Strangely enough, something which I never did expect to happen, it became very popular, and the man who makes them for me is a former student of mine called Stelios Petrakis, who is in his own right a wonderful musician and extremely good instrument maker. He has made and sold over 250 of them now, and so they seem to have spread around. Yeah.
Ross is also the catalyst behind an annual summer festival of acoustic music that transforms the quiet village of Hudetsi for 4 days every August. Thousands are attracted to the festival, and it provides a welcome economic boost for the region, as well as an artistic highlight in the calendar. Ross believes that the workshops and the festival have had another unplanned effect.
One other thing which has been extremely positive with regards to all of these people coming to either teach or to study here in the village from many different countries, we've had people from a total of 36 different countries coming here, is that it's quite a serious countermeasure to an unfortunate increasing nationalist tendency which is taking hold in the country right now. You know, due to the economic crisis, this is something which often happens in countries which are going through severe economic problems, is that there is an increase in nationalism and sort of extremist ideology. Unfortunately, we do actually have that happening here in Greece as well. We have a very noxious party known as Golden Dawn, which is not just a far-right party, it's an outright Nazi party with people wearing swastikas and singing the praise of people like Hitler and things like that, which is extremely strange for Greece because it did suffer miserably under the boot of Nazism in World War II. So it's a bit, we're at a bit of a loss to explain it, actually. But anyway, it is actually happening here. But the fact that in our village and in the area in general, people have seen the benefit of you know, people coming from abroad to study, to be with us here. This is quite a serious countermeasure to all of this nationalist tendency. And there are a lot of children who've grown up in our village alongside Labyrinth, which has been in operation now for 12 years in the village. So when we came here, there were people who were 10 years old and who are now 22. And they've been, you know, every year they've been interacting with people from different parts of the world, and they've been, their perspective has been broadening quite considerably. So, you know, the percentage of people who support extremist nationalist ideologies and things in our village or in our area here is extremely small, it's minimal. So, and I think that our activities here have certainly played a positive role in that development.
Contillies performed there by the Ross Daly Quartet. That programme, The Road to Modal, was recorded in 2014 and was presented and produced by J.J. O'Shea. The programme was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland from the television licence fee.